What's going on, everyone? Tanner Poppett here of Madrost and Poppett's Corner. Just reminding you that our new record, Charring the Rotting Earth, is now available at NoLifeTomatoRecords.com. That's right. Just go on the search bar, type in NoLifeTomatoRecords.com, and support. Again, NoLifeTomatoRecords.com. Now, let's check out the episode you came to see.
You are about to enter the Shockwave Skull Sessions podcast on ShockwaveSkullSessions.com. And now your host, Bob Nalbandian.
This Shockwave Skull Sessions video cast, we got the one and only, the mean man, Mr. Chris Hall. And we got the director of the brand new documentary on Chris Holmes, entitled Mean Man, the story of Chris Holmes, the last true rock and roller, available on Cleopatra Records. The director of the film, Antoine. How you doing, Antoine?
Nice to meet you. Fantastic. And happy to be back with Chris.
Very cool, man. We've been in contact for a while, Antoine, when you were starting this movie. And why don't you talk a little bit about how this film came into a fruition?
Well, actually, that's a long story, because I think it was like 5 years in the making, and it all started, like most projects, by pure accident. Obviously, I am a huge Wasp fan for years, and it was quite interesting because when Chris came to live in France, which I think was 2014, and he can say if it's a proper date, nobody knew Chris left the US for France. There was not a word in the media, not many people knew. And I was filming interviews at the Hellfest Festival in France. And all of a sudden, in the backstage area, I see a huge man with tattoos all over the arms, big beard already. And I was like talking to my friend and saying, this guy, I'm sure this is Chris Holmes from Wasp, but I don't know why the fuck he's here, because no one knew about that. And we just went to speak. He was with Sarah, his wife. And we just started to do just a small interview. And actually, it was really, really interesting because the guy was so cool. He welcomed us. So we were supposed to do a 5 minute interview, and it was finally like a 20 minute interview. And we just felt like he had a really nice contact, really good touch. And some really popular stars are very difficult to approach and to talk to. And he was the most down-to-earth guy, you know. And as you can imagine, his reputation always precedes him. So people sometimes have a totally wrong image of him. And we just discovered it was the opposite. And from there, just started a relationship between us, Chris, and his wife, Sarah. But we had no purpose at all. We just met and became quickly friends. We just went to do some music videos for them in the south of France. And it was an honor for us to work on one of our childhood heroes, especially since he was so kind to us. I don't know if he remembers all this, but it was a very important moment for us. And when you live in France, it's very difficult to approach American artists. You never get that chance. And to have an American artist coming in France for a living, willing to do some video projects with you, that's kind of an honor and a big challenge. So we thought, okay, we need to document this and to start following him, and we see what we can make of it. And he quickly became pissed off with the cameras all the time.
Very cool. Now, Chris, you originally moved to Finland, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And how was it there, beside it being real cold?
I don't know if you can consider it a move. I went there to play with a group. I didn't know how long it was going to last. I thought maybe could have lasted a year, could have lasted 5 years. It only lasted for a few months. They were more involved in their drinking and being rock stars than doing the music aspect first, and then the whatever second. The partying was first. It was a joke. It was like a garage band. I got tired of it, and then Sarah goes, let's go visit her parents in Cannes. I didn't know, or we didn't know what we were going to do, and we came here, and I met some guys to play with, and then we decided to stay here. And then I went to Hellfest and met Antoine at Hellfest. Right. You know?
Dude, I got to tell you, the band you have is incredible.
Well, I've been through a few band members, you know. I've been through two drummers, two bass players, two singers, you know, and I'm a singer, so it's like I need somebody to sing the wah stuff.
Right.
You know, cause I'd sing mine, but I'd be crucified singing that. But yeah, but and they speak English.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he still doesn't want to learn French. He's been living in France for like 6 years, and he doesn't want to learn anything.
The first hasn't been that long. Wow.
The first guy's French. You know, they were French. They said bad things about me. They talked French. I didn't understand it. I don't know if they did or not, but yeah. But they did. These other guys speak English, and I get along with them real good. The other guys I got along with, but I don't know. But the documentary thing, you know, meeting Antoine, he was cool. He came in helped me out when I needed it at the right time, you know.
All right, man. And we should also give, I guess, a Laurent Hart credit as well. Did he like kind of co-direct with you, Antoine?
Actually, yes. Laurent is my partner when it comes to filming many interviews. We created a channel together called Duke TV, right, where we film interviews. We got some other people helping. But most of the time, Laurent could come with us and follow Chris. And they got along very well, Laurent and Chris.
Yeah.
Total opposite. He's completely bald, and Chris is like filled with hair and this huge charisma, this presence. It was really a nice team. But it's not like the Osbournes. We didn't live in the house for days and weeks. We tried to join them at some point in time when they went to the Czech Republic, some tour in different parts of Europe. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's always budget issues because you cannot travel everywhere.
When I was living in Finland, I did one show there, one show where I sang for the first time in my life. And what the other band members, two of them were so wasted, they weren't even playing the right song. The drummer was keeping time. And Antoine came and filmed really the first time where I ever really sang in front of people, you know, where I switched from, I'm not saying I switched from singing. I just sing my own songs, you know.
I actually got the goosebumps because you can see in the first half of the documentary, all the first shows Chris did. And yes, there's the first show where he ever was the lead singer, which is in Nantes. It was the release party for the album Shooting Bricks.
Okay.
And that was quite impressive because we just went to film all the backstage, the beginning of the day. And when he started playing, I remember Animal, just hearing the riff of Animal Fought Like a Beast, just gave everyone the chills, goosebumps. It was like amazing seeing him on stage being the frontman. But it didn't occur until he performed his own songs. At the time, it was like Let It Roar, Shooting Bricks. And just to see Chris singing and the crowd, it was a brilliant show, the first one ever, and the crowd went really wild. You can see that in the documentary. And you can see I love this sequence in the beginning where you can see Chris in the backstage area. And honestly, I think Chris is not afraid of anything or anyone. But in that sequence, I'm not sure, maybe Chris would tell, but you could feel some kind of nervosity, anxiety, because it was going to be the first time ever singing in front of the audience for like 1 hour and a half show.
Yeah, I was a little nervous, kind of. I don't know if I said that. I remember in the video, I go, this is the first time I'll ever sing, right?
Yeah.
I said that, yeah. I go, this is the first show I'm ever going to sing, you know, so. But if you look at it, I don't have to sing the whole show. You know, because I got the other guitar player, whatever, to do the wah song, so it's half and half, you know. But it's still, right, it was still hard at, I think I was 57, you know, never sang in front of anybody in my life. It's kind of hard to, bam, just do it, you know. But now I do it. I don't give a crap now, you know. But,
and it was impressive to see the whole energy. And honestly, we didn't expect that. We were thinking, okay, we're going to film a cool show. We never thought it was going to be that intense. And that gave us the will to see more and to be able to follow them on more shows. And we started just from this kind of live project, filming them, to a whole different adventure.
Yeah. And then Antoine got to go to America.
Yeah, oh, we'll talk about that. I love the way that you film. You talk about, you know, going to the check and going and following the band around, shooting their live shows, shooting them backstage. And then you went to America and you've got so many great interviews from both in France and America with, you know, Chris's mom and sister and his old childhood friends and old Wasp roadies and old band mates, of course, Estet Howland and Johnny Rod. You got Danny Phil from Cradle of Filth, Scott Ian. Talk about that process from, you know, shooting them all over Europe and then coming to America.
Yeah, actually, I think after a year or two, we started thinking, especially with Chris and Sarah, because Sarah has a very important role in it as well, because she has the vision and she has a really she has really good decisions when it comes to promoting Chris and his image. And we didn't know, I think for me, I'm a typical French guy. We don't do things like unexpected and or amazing. And to see Chris, who has this amazing charisma, his life, which is for me quite of really complex and at the same time beautiful, because he's got this whole process from the US, from fame, celebrity, alcohol. Like Chris had the dream life every teenager dreamt about when we were young. Everyone wanted to be Chris. But then, of course, he also went through some dark times, some unhappy times, but he managed to rise again and to come back maybe stronger. And he still has this fantastic, fantastic personality where you can see that he's always going to keep going and to persevere in his music adventure. So this thing was quite convincing, and discussing with Sarah, seeing his life in Cannes, and Chris is a really funny man. He's got a huge charisma. When he walks into a room, everyone is going to notice Chris. Not only because he's a huge, tall guy that everyone sees, but because he has this incredible presence. And it's difficult to talk of that in front of him, but yeah. So it's like you cannot even you couldn't write a movie or a fiction stuff and imagine such a character. And we've been lucky with our channel to film many rock stars, many artists. Chris has something unique in his history, his background, but also his personality. And absolutely, everything, every day when you walk around with Chris, there's always things happening, always something's funny. He always has some amazing words or thoughts about the people he sees, the things he does. So whenever you get the camera, there's always something happening. And quite quickly, we just had hours and hours of rushes. And we didn't know if we wanted to try to create maybe some kind of reality show, just following Chris and Sarah in their day-to-day life, or to go deep into his whole life and background and musical history. But quickly, I think we understood that it was important for people to see the whole history of Chris from, of course, the era that everyone knows about Wasp, well, most people know, but also the dark times and everything he's been doing since he left Wasp in the early 20s, which is, I think, now 20 years ago. So there's a whole lot of things that happened since then.
Absolutely.
So when we decided to do that and to start the real documentary process, which I think was 3 years ago, of course we had to go film people in the US, because as a fan, I know what I think I want to know about Chris, and I know the people I would love to see talking about Chris and many different eras of the history of Chris Holmes and his different bands. So we just made a list with Chris and Sarah of the people we could meet and interview. I would have loved to have all the former members of Wasp, but I couldn't have the contacts of everyone. And maybe some people didn't want to participate. It's complicated to know, but we wanted to make this very neutral documentary, it's not like the apology of Chris Holmes. I think we wanted to have the views of everyone. So we made this list, and yes, it was fantastic, because thanks to Chris and thanks to Sarah, I was able to fly to the US and meet some amazing people. There's people that everyone knows in the film, like, of course, Johnny Rod, Estet Howland. There's people that from his family. I think it was important to have his mother, because she became famous on a quite famous swimming pool scene. And there's some people that are not known, that Chris' childhood friends, and I think they are really important, because they can show the consistency of Chris's personality since he was a teenager. And I think he's one of the only rock stars I ever met that never changed and whose success never affected his views and his way of being. So,
absolutely.
But I'm talking a lot. I think Chris needs to talk more than me.
I wish a reality show thing would have happened, you know. But you know what killed that was Gene Simmons.
That's why Family
Jewels.
Well, no, the reality show that Ozzy kind of started, you know, Ozzy, right. And that was cool. Everybody loved it. Everybody watched it every time it was on. And all of a sudden, Gene Simmons gets the idea to do his, and he kills it because his was boring. It was boring. Nobody liked it. So, you know, Ozzy's was funny because the guy's got personality. You know, Gene's was like, just, you know, it was like a lot of people's food. It's boring. Killed it.
Yeah. And I think if we had done it, and that's what people love about Chris, I think.
Well, you can still do it, man.
The thing with Chris is, you know him, he's 100% real. There's nothing fake about him. Everyone keeps saying it in a documentary. There are maybe still people who don't believe that, but he never plays. He's always the man you can see right here.
And well, that's the thing about Chris, and I think that really shows in this movie, is that Chris does his own thing. He doesn't give a shit. And just like the title says, really, you are the last true rock and roller that has that attitude and that, you know, I don't give a shit attitude. So many others have just given in, got older or whatever, but you've really kept that integrity since the beginning, Chris, since before Wasp. And that really, people have to admire that, whether they like you or not. You got to respect that, man.
But you need to tell us your history with Chris, because you guys have been friends for a very long time.
Not really. We didn't really. I mean, I followed Wasp, but I always kind of feared Chris because, you know, when I saw Wasp, I was like, you know, 16, 17, when I'd see him at the Troubadour and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, and I saw him many times. I did do an interview. I think that was with Blackie and Richard for this documentary. I was curious because I know Chris had played with him, you know, in the early 2000s.
With who?
Randy Piper and Tony Richards.
Yeah. Well, they tried to get to do when I played with Animal. I picked up Tony in Phoenix and we drove out and played, but it was discussed. Tony that didn't want to, he didn't want to be anchored out of Cincinnati. He wanted to stay in Arizona, you know. And he had, put it this way, he had to stay in Arizona. He had some legal issues where wasn't able to leave the state yet. I mean, it wasn't due to drugs or whatever. So I think it's a, I hope he's not mad I say this, but I think it's an alimony payment. But I'm not 100%. Yeah, I think, but you got to pay whatever to make money to pay that. So he was stuck in Arizona. So he didn't play in a band. I just went out and played with him for a year or so or whatever until that broke up, you know, until they ran it bad, you know. I just can't wait to get playing again, man.
Well, dude, we all are excited to see you. Hopefully you'll be able to come out to the States and do some shows once you now, do you have the new record? It's all recorded. I saw in the documentary you were recording and during the whole go ahead.
Yeah, well, I got to finish till we can get our drummer in to play the drums and you can get him out of England to record him, to play him. You know, I got to wait and do that on all the stuff. So I'm kind of half in limbo, half not. You know, until the COVID's done.
Right. But going back to what you were saying, Antoine, I did follow Chris through the obviously the Wasp years. I saw some of the shows you did with Psycho Squad. And also, I wanted to ask you as well, Chris, about the band you had with one of my favorite drummers, Filthy Animal Taylor, who was an absolute legend. You played with him for a while in LA, and I remember hearing a lot about it. Did you ever, I know you did some recordings. Did you ever release them or are they available or will they be available?
My first record I did called Nothing to Lose is all Phil playing on it.
Oh, that is Phil. Okay.
Yeah. He's playing on it. And it's done electronically. It's not done acoustically. It's done.
Okay.
It's done on acoustic drums into a computer. Still played, though.
Right.
Still
right.
played. That's because we were in an apartment when we did the record. And of course, you can't play with amps and stuff real loud, you know. And I played with him. He's one that actually got me to sing on something. It was because of him, you know. And if I never met him, I wouldn't be doing this right now, here today. I wouldn't be doing this at all. It's because of, a lot of it's because of Phil. You know, gave me enough. I don't know the word for it.
I think we froze up a little bit.
It might disappear.
It'll come. Hopefully, it'll come back. You got it. There it is. Yep.
Yeah, it'll come back. There, Antoine.
Yeah, we're here.
It does that. It does that. I don't know whose computer's shutting off, but anyway. Well, no, I was talking about Phil. Yeah. It was a thing that we were figuring out the computer. Phil wanted to figure out how it recorded with Pro Tools, and he needed somebody to play guitar because he didn't play guitar. So I came over to his house one day to play, and we just became real, really close friends and did it every night, about three times a week for a long time. You know, then we decided to get weird to do a record, and it was going to be an instrumental. Then I sang on a song as a joke. And it just took one step further. And then right when we were going to get the record mixed, it had, it was half and half. It had a few instrumentals. If you sing, he had brain aneurysm. Boom. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was it. He couldn't remember after that. So. Happens to everybody. You never know when you're going to go. You know.
Actually, there's one interview we did which was very touching, especially was Chris had just came back from England after Phil's passing away, and he was very emotional to talk about Phil, and I think he had just passed away a couple of days before. And that interview was, you know, the thing with documentaries, because you've done many, Bob, and There are some sequences you would like to last for 10 minutes because they are so touching and they get so many feelings and emotions and interesting facts. So, but we had to shorten it for the documentary. But I kind of remember that, Chris is a strong man, but you could feel how affected he was by the importance of Phil in his life and the fact that he passed away sooner than expected.
Yeah, it's very sad. I wanted to ask you, Chris, because I know in 2000, I think around 2010 or so, you got back together with Randy and I believe Tony for a while, or it was the WAS project or WAS, where Angel Suffer, I believe it was called. Yeah,
it was supposed to be WAS with the P broke off on the side.
Right.
That was the logo, you know, where Angel Suffer. That was Randy's band.
Right.
It was mine.
Similar to Animal, yeah.
Yes, and Stett Hallen was the drummer.
Okay, that's right.
And Steve Unger was a bass player from Metal Church. He was a bass player. And then Rich Lewis, the guy that sang in Animal previously. And he sang with Randy from the day Randy left WASP or was thrown out or whatever the hell. When he was gone, he worked with Randy since then. So everybody was kind of close-knit. And then I came in. I was the last person in the thing to get it going, and then Randy gets thrown out of his own band.
Oh, wow.
Thrown out. They got somebody else, and it just didn't have the same vibe and didn't work right, you know, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I was sitting in L.A. going like this, you know, waiting, and I was like, screw it, man. I met some guys from Finland. I said, I'm going to take a chance and go play with them. And in 2014, I sold everything. Got rid of my dog, my car, the place where I lived. I just got rid of everything and went, you know. Me and my wife left.
Can you believe it? I think it's probably been like 6 years, maybe that's seven crazy. Soon, that he never came back to the U.S. Can you imagine living for so long?
You made the right decision, man. I should have joined you. But you definitely did the right thing. Well, you know, WASP was always, I mean, WASP always had a big fan base, obviously, in the States. But, you know, you in particular with, you know, your I don't give a fuck attitude, really, I think, really in Europe, they really
had a love for you, you know, and from the beginning of Wasp, and I think it was always there all over Europe. I mean, Wasp always had a much bigger following in Europe.
And plus Los Angeles since probably 2000, since the trade centers, whatever, it's been right. Just going downhill. All clubs are closing. There's hardly any good venues. On Sunset Strip, there's only one venue left. Yeah. It's a whiskey. The Roxy had been open. The Key Club's closed. It's not closed. Beyonce owns it. You know, and Beyonce owns it, right? And Wasp is not.
Yeah, One Oak or something. I think it's called the old Key Club. Yeah.
House of Blues is torn down. You know, so all the places are gone. So it's probably, you know, it's, I don't know.
No, you're right, man.
And you know what's beautiful about living here? In the last 6 years, I've been bothered once by a cop.
Yeah, I heard that in the documentary. That's great. Oh. And I want to tell people to check out the Blu-ray of the documentary. The documentary, by the way, is available on Cleopatra Entertainment and is available on Blu-ray, DVD. I believe you have it on Amazon Prime. I know it's on Amazon Prime. I believe here in the States, Vudu, you could get it, and Google Play, many other digital platforms. But the Blu-ray has some great bonus features, about 2 hours worth of bonus features. Is that right, Antoine?
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, we'll play a couple coming up.
Yeah, there's so many cool stuff that you want to keep, and I think it was important. As a fan, I was sometimes very disappointed to need to leave out some parts because we didn't have enough time. We just wanted to have this film, which was very dynamic, impactful, and I think documentary movies, when they exceed probably 1.5 hours, you can lose that energy. So we decided to leave out many parts, but it's still for fans. I think there's so many interesting stuff because Chris's life has been filled with amazing encounters, anecdotes, and even his opinions on life, on things like religion, politics. I think everything needs to be his childhood. Not many people know about his childhood. So I think for the diehard fans who want to know really more about it, I think it was important to be able to go deep into these bonus things. So yes.
Well, that's what I love. I love that you get into his childhood and you talk about, you know, his relationship with Eddie Van Halen, which a lot of people were unaware of. You know, you grew up in Pasadena. You were a big part of that Pasadena rock scene, and of course you played a lot of those clubs. You played the Starwood, you had Buster Savage and a few other bands prior to Wasp, so you were a big part of that San Gabriel Valley scene. Why don't you talk a little bit about those days, Chris?
Oh god, those were just alcohol, drug and filled, no give a crap attitude, have a good time, you know,
right on.
Don't even look over your shoulder, look forward. It was those days. I can remember those days. I don't know how many times I was pulled over driving drunk, wasted. Cop go, a little high there, huh? I'm okay. Can you make it home? Go home. Not even get you out of the car, you know. That's the way. Then, yeah. That's the way it used to be. You know, instead of pull you over nowadays, but it there's a lot of influences. I don't know. Being around Van Halen, in my teens, taught me a lot about, I couldn't forsake the future, but just taught me a lot about guitar. I learned a lot about sound, just sound being around Ed. You know, if I wasn't around him, I definitely wouldn't be how I play today. I wouldn't definitely play that way. You know, I don't play like him, but it's just, I learned a lot of stuff, and I just took what I wanted, what I needed to know. Lots of fun learned, and I just being around him, you know, he was really one of the coolest musicians I personally know, besides Phil and Taylor, as a human being, to treat other people, you know, as a human being. There's a lot of other guitar players that came out of Pasadena that were there. Carlos Covaza lived there for a long time in Arcadia.
Great guy. Yeah,
Carlos, because he was from Snow. From that same area, Arcadia is really close to Pasadena. There's a band, there's a band called Smile.
Yeah,
Tommy Gervin. He went and played with some
Eddie Money.
There's a I forget his name, played contraband name was Rick, I think.
What band was that?
They were called Pretty Poison.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was Richard's from Shark Island's old band.
Shark Island. From the Sharks. Yeah. Singer, Rick, he sang with Contraband. I don't know what he ever did after that.
Right.
Spencer, he was a cool guy. He never got that far in the business, but he's a killer player. You know, and nobody has ever mentioned a guy named Terry Kilgore, but he was a killer player.
Yeah, so, well, a lot of people said he taught Van Halen a lot of the tapping stuff. Or through you mentioned through Howie Mandel or Harvey Mandel, Howie Mandel.
Yeah, I introduced him to Terry, and then Terry. This was us about 15, and Terry.
It's a great story.
The next lesson was doing it really crazy, and then Ed, about a month later, Ed picked it up. That's where I've never seen Ed do it before. But that's and you pick up things you don't, from seeing watching people play. I know, and. Before I ran into Ed, I know him and Terry were kind of rivals because Terry's 3 years older than me, which Ed's 3 years older. So they went to the same, they were in the same high school together and all that stuff. So yeah. And
I remember you mentioned another guitar player who no one really speaks of. He had since passed away, Jimmy Bates from Stormer, who had the killer guitar tone. And he
he passed away, did he?
Yeah, I think he passed away a few years ago. Yeah.
Oh man, he was like Iommi.
Yeah, I know Eddie was a big fan of his as well, Eddie Van Halen.
Great player, man. He played left-handed, a right-handed guitar left-handed. Upside down.
Like Hendrix.
Hendrix strung the strings.
Oh, I got you. I see what you're saying.
That one on the top and the real thin one on the bottom. He had them backwards. So he had just played a wicked different way than he could normally play, and great sound, just great. The good out of the 70s came some real people with some really good sound of tone generators.
Well, dude, you had the best tone from back then, I remember. But so many guitar players, of course, George Lynch was an exciter, and of course, Randy Rhoads, you had there playing the local circuit on Quiet Riot. And all these bands, Dave Menichetti from Y&T, they would come down all the time. And like you said, Carlos Cavazo was in Snow. So many great players on this. Greg Leon, of course. Yeah, another Pasadena guy who made quite an impact on that scene. And, I remember when we did the interview for the Inside Metal stuff, and you were talking how you and Eddie Van Halen, he would come over to your bedroom and you guys would just jam, and you would loan him equipment for a lot of their early shows. And I remember you told me one great story is that he was playing, you said, hold on a second, Ed, and you opened up all your windows.
Yeah. And he just goes, hey, your window's open, your neighbors are going to complain. I'm going to fuck the neighbors, And he goes, okay. So, and I was, in my head, I was going, I hope they think that's me playing.
That's great, man. Yeah, it's such a sad story about it.
He just had a certain touch then. Yeah, you don't live forever. In 100 years from right now, this world's still going to be turning, right?
Yeah.
Whether the human race is on it or not, but we're all going to be gone. All of us.
That's right. Well, I'm glad you're around and you seem very healthy, man. You just got vaccinated. You're in great spirits. Talking about the Roxy, I think the last time I saw that was open is you did a jam there. And this was probably around, mid-2000s, 2010 or whatever. You did one of those Club Vodka shows. And I think I talked about it on your documentary, Antoine. And I just remember you getting on stage and just killing it. And that was like the last time. And I had seen you perform, and you had obviously moved to Europe shortly after. But when you did that performance, it was just like, this is what we've been waiting for. Because LA, like you said, everything got so tame. There was no balls anymore. And I remember you came up and did "I Don't Need No Doctor" and just fucking blew everyone away. And it was like, God damn it, this is rock and roll. Chris Holmes definitely is the last true rock and roller.
They'd always have me play at the end, the big balls, the last three songs. I used to love playing that. It was great.
Right on, man.
But I've played with some cool people, met some cool people. Billy Idol played that.
Oh, did he? Oh, I didn't know that. Really?
That was went on for a few years, the big balls. But he played one show, just one show, not a bunch of times.
Right.
Anyway. Let's get back to the documentary. Antoine.
Antoine. You want to show a clip?
Always follow me around with the camera, I mean, I need to go on the bathroom, go take a crap and put my pants on. I'd be like, look up, there's a camera wasn't there.
I think he's right. We do have one or two bathroom sequences, but we had to cut them out.
Well, you did follow him around everywhere. Was that kind of annoying, Chris? Or how did you at first?
You seem pretty comfortable. You get used to it. It's not annoying. It's just you get used to it, you know?
I think also when you do this type of film, you need to get the confidence from the people you're filming. And I think the first couple of years were quite important because we had to get familiar with each other. I don't think someone you don't know can come in and follow you around for like 3 years because it's really, and so we've been quite lucky to become friends, to have some fun. And I was quite privileged to, with Laurent filming most of the sequences with me, we were quite privileged to get inside this inner circle and be able to film more and more, because sometimes you just get to the place where they're going to have dinner and you're going to film him with other people. Sometimes you can feel some tension before the shows or between the band members or whatever reason. So it's very difficult to be here. It seems fluid and easy when you see the movie, but some sequences you really had to pull them for them to be on the camera and to be there. And it's quite a challenge, I think.
Well, you really captured it, man. And I love the way you filmed. You really got the true essence of what Chris is all about, because everyone knows Chris as the mean man, but then they see him and you know, he's just really just such a nice person that really cares about his fans. And that's what I thought was so special, because you know, you always heard about stories about Blackie and the way he treated fans and other people. And you know, everyone that I've ever spoke with, even you know, before the documentary, everyone I've ever spoke with that have toured with Wasp back in the early days, they said they just had a kinship with Chris Holmes, and that, you know, and you know, Chris had the reputation obviously of being the crazy guy, but everyone said no, Chris was the coolest guy. He did whatever he could to help us, and everyone has always said that about you, Chris.
Yeah. What's impressive is every show Chris and his band did, they always did meet and greets, free meet and greets. You don't have to pay for it, and he always stayed as long as he had to meet everyone, to sign everything, to talk to everyone, and you can never see any sign of being tired, exhausted, and he always gives the maximum to the fans, and that in itself is impressive because he's very accessible, very down to earth, and I think that's why people love him. And in a way, that's what I keep telling to people. Meeting Chris changes many things in my own life and the way I saw things. I saw the music scene. I saw the concept of success, the rise and fall of rock stars. Meeting Chris was really quite a learning experience, honestly.
All right.
And it's impressive to see that every city is still going to have fans coming to the shows, wanting to meet him. And what we try to show in the documentary as well is, I think that's really hot and warming. I don't know if it's the proper word, but it's really, really touching to see so many people who see Chris for the first time, and you can see the smile on their face and the way that the impact that Chris had on many, many, many people's lives. That's, I think, very important. People don't notice that enough, I think.
Absolutely, man.
And I love the fact that I just say that and Chris stays completely neutral. I love it.
You know, another thing a lot of people don't know, and, you know, we'll play the bonus clip here on this in a minute. You actually auditioned for Randy for Ozzy after Randy Rhoads first passed away. And were you
not after he passed away? I auditioned for Ozzy the night that Ozzy saw him.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Yeah. That's right. Before he got Randy. Yeah. And you ended up going to the Quiet Riot show that Randy played, and Ozzy was there. No.
I auditioned. Went to the place and played at 8 o'clock. It was in Laurel Canyon in somebody's garage, way up on Lookout Mountain, at somebody's house. I don't know who. Dana Strum set it up. He says, "Go to this address, bring your guitar and amp, set it up, and we'll be there at 8 o'clock." And that's what I did. Ozzy came in. I could have been 19, whatever. And I was told not to play any Black Sabbath songs, which I like blew my mind. And what am I going to play? I only played with just me, nobody else. Nobody else. It's kind of stupid. I should have figured out that when he walked in and looked at me, I should have didn't even play because he said something about my height. I remember that. Mm. And that night, that was a Friday night, Quiet Riot was playing the Whiskey. Okay. They went to see Quiet Riot that night. They went to go have dinner at the Rainbow or something and go see Quiet Riot play at, 11:30. And Jesse took Randy the next day.
Wow. I was going to play the clip. I guess you kind of explained it, but we'll go ahead and play the clip anyway. Let me see if I could get this going here.
I tried out for Ozzy when in 1979. Somebody called me for the audition. It was before Wasp, right after Sister. How stupid was that? You think he's going to take me? Ozzy Osbourne? He took Randy Rhoads, a little short guy, you know? Of course he's not going to take you. Ozzy's about comes up to here on me. He's not going to stand next to me on stage. Who called me? Dana Strum from Bad Axe called me. He was running around looking, helping Ozzy look for musicians. And had an audition. I went up there and just played my guitar by myself for about 10 minutes in front of him. And then that night, we went down to Quiet Riot was playing the Whiskey that night. I remember him talking about they're going to go see Quiet Riot play. And he took, I guess Ozzy took him that next day, took him to England. Asked Randy Rhoads if he wanted a gig. So we got the gig, you know. Was I disappointed? I was mad at the audition when Dana Strum told me don't play any Black Sabbath songs. Oh, no. Stupid. That's what I used to model myself after Tony Iommi. I love the way the guy his sound, you know. So I just had to go there and play some riffs and some stupid songs without no drummer or bass player by myself.
Talk a little bit about, Chris, before we go. I know the tour you did, which was a huge tour, and people still talk about to this day, was the Wasp Metallica Armored Saint tour. And you and Wasp and Metallica were obviously kind of co-headlining, and you were flipping bills depending on the cities. I know in certain places like Philadelphia, you guys, Wasp headlined, and other places, Metallica headlined. But it was, kind of equal status. This was back in 1984. What do you remember from that?
They headlined one night, and we headlined the next night after that. We played in Buffalo once, right? And it was snowing really bad, and we just came in. Everybody just came over the border from Toronto or whatever, northern in Canada, came through the border there, and I pull in, and the Wasp bus pulls in. And starts. In fact, I think five people showed up at the show. It was snowing that bad that night, but at sound check, Cliff had got off the bus at the border to take a piss, and they got on the bus and took off and left them. They had to go back and pick,
without knowing.
They had to go back and pick them up. It was funny because I remember that. And there's some fun times with those guys. We were all young, you know. Music to us was new. You know, we were all in our 20s, and it was 1984. And they were great guys. You know, the Metallica guys. They all treated me great. You know, there was a few things, you know, between our band member, Blackie, and them about a few things. But other than that, it was great. I remember once after the show, a pizza guy comes up, and I open the door, and he bangs up, and the name of their tour manager was Bobby something. Bobby, it could have been Bobby Snyder. Here? He goes, Bobby Snyder here? And I go, yeah, here, right here. And the guy goes, okay, here's the pizzas you guys ordered. I go, thanks, dude. And I grabbed them. It was their pizzas for their bus. You know, just things like that.
Right.
You know, we took them and pulled out and took off. They weren't even, and they were the guy. You know, they were paid for by the promoter. You know, just things like that.
Right.
You know, we got hammered and drunk and beat up each other and everybody in the hotels. You know, we stayed in the same hotels a few times. And it was great. It's great. It makes me, I'm proud to say that I'm still today, the all those guys, friends, you know, I still consider them best friends, you know, and it's great to see the success and how big that they went to from where, you know, we were all at the same level at that time, same albums sold, blah, 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 blah. And to see how they kept their whole organization together with everybody in the band. I'm sure if Cliff didn't die, he'd probably still be in the band.
Definitely.
Who's to say they'd be as famous as they are now if he didn't die? I don't know. I would like to say I hope so. You know, I'm not going to say because of the death. It's like saying, would AC/DC be as big as they were if Bon Scott was still alive? You don't know.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because of circumstances. But what a shitty circumstance Cliff dying was, you know. But it's great. It's great that they got, that they went to the status they're at today. You know, and every time I've seen the guys in the band, you know, they treat me like a king, whatever. They're great people. Like a Californian native, you know.
Yeah. I know you toured with Anthrax, and of course, Scott Ian had said some great stuff about you, that you treated them with the utmost respect. And, you know, like I said, everyone I've spoken to that have played with Wasp back in the day had said the same things about you.
Yeah. It's probably could be because of California attitude.
Well, a lot of people were very competitive on the LA scene, and you had a lot of those LA bands that were at each other's throats, and they didn't want the others to succeed, and they would, you know, they would fuck up their, you know, their stage show with, you know, not giving them enough sound or doing this and that or whatever, just to, you know, make sure that they always have the upper hand. You know, it was very competitive, but you were always cool with everyone, which, you know, I do want to make that point across, and it comes across in the documentary. And, you know, that's.
Yeah, you gotta be, you know, I'm no better than anybody else. That's the way I look at it. You know, everybody's the same. You know, right. some people think they're better than other people, but that's just their problem. Let them deal with it. You know, we all come into this world alone. We're all going to go out alone.
Yeah, that is so true.
Oh, yeah.
Antoine, anything else? Any other great or funny stories while doing the documentary, or any kind of situations that you want to talk about?
I got one. Antoine came this close to playing with me live.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Came this close.
What happened? They were. We didn't put that
in the close.
I think he would have kicked me out quite quickly. No, actually, it was funny because I used to play the drums and I had kind of
level. Did you play with Tom?
Yes, actually, the cool thing is I just went to play at the end of the rehearsal, and they were still looking for a drummer, I think. And I went to play the drums, and it was quite fun. Plus, when you get to play, I think it was Wild Child and Sleeping in the Fire with Chris Holmes in the room, you just get completely crazy. It's like living a dream. So I had this chance, and actually, it was kind of really working well. But and I needed a drummer quite a couple of months afterwards, I think. But unfortunately, me being in Paris, they being in Cannes, I wasn't sure I was going to be able to have enough time. And I wasn't really a professional drummer as well. So in the end, they found some really nice and funny Italian drummer who's called Forkert. Really amazing guy who just stayed in the band for the next years. I think nearly all along the documentary, you can see this lineup, because that was the time when we just followed them around. But yes, I had the pleasure to play with Chris. I also had the pleasure to play with Johnny Rodd, because when I went to film him in St. Louis, Missouri, he was rehearsing with a band and he just offered to play. So I got to play, I think it was Wild Child again with Johnny Rodd. And that's some really, really nice memory that just sticks into your mind, because you don't get to play with your childhood heroes, this type of stuff. It was really amazing.
Plus, we've seen some really, when Antoine's been out on the road with us, we've been to some really, really cool places in Norway. Remember all those tunnels?
Yeah, we went to the fjords in Bergen. Actually,
Bergen.
That's where we went. Cool places in the world, in Europe, and I was quite lucky enough to be able to follow them. So that was quite cool. And sometimes you had to accommodate because, as you know, we had no budget. So I think more than once I had to sleep in Chris and Sarah's room, sometimes on the floor. That was kind of interesting. But we got the chance to have sometimes some cool hotels and cool stuff. Plus, I got to go to Chris's sister in Wyoming in the US. And that was also a life-changing experience, because the people there are so cool. And you had to cross the Yellowstone National Park.
Right.
And So I got my car stuck, my car was stuck by buffaloes just walking past me. And I called Chris and I said, I cannot drive because there's buffaloes. And he says, no, you just drive. You just drive over and they're going to.
Yeah, just run them over. They'll get out of your way. Just run them over. You get the car right up on them and they'll move. They wait till you push them out of the way.
I wouldn't want to get in a fight with one of those things. Those things are huge. They could destroy a car.
But the most important thing, and you can see that in the movie as well, but maybe the biggest thing I learned is that Chris loves dogs. And you can see in the movie that they had three dogs at some point, Chris and Sarah, at their home. And you can see the love of Chris with his dogs because he's always friends with the animals. And
so Chris must hate Ozzy Osbourne for biting the head off the doves, huh?
No.
It was, interesting. Chris loves doves. That's a great.
No, the dogs. The dogs that bark.
Oh, dogs, know? Dogs. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought you were saying doves.
I'm French, so sometimes I get confused.
Okay. Yeah. No, I know that. I remember when back at your dog in L.A. when we interviewed you, how close you were with your dog. You know, your dog was everywhere with you.
I like animals, you know. It'd be
you
great.
Make a movie about Chris and Doug.
Sarah and yeah, and we all went out to dinner afterwards, and we were at the Al Bain studio where we did the interview.
Man, didn't I had a Shih Tzu?
You had a Shih Tzu. Yep,
a little white one. Yeah, those are great. I love those dogs. They're great. They don't even bark.
Yeah,
they don't bark.
Yeah, I say that dog was so quiet. It's so well mannered. Yeah,
Shih Tzus are great.
And one thing we need to say as well, because I met so many cool people thanks to Chris, and that's just a fantastic human experience, just to meet so many cool people as you. And what most people don't know is if people get the chance to see the movie right now, it's also thanks to you, because you were able to introduce us to Cleopatra. So we will never thank you enough, because you've been the most important link between this movie and the audience right now. So that means
my pleasure, Antoine and Chris. And I, you know, like I said, anything I could do to help, I'm so glad that this documentary came into fruition. I think it was super important. As Chris pointed out, it's the first member of WASP to have a documentary. And now there's such an influx of these documentaries coming in now with all these streaming services. You know, a lot of bands are putting documentaries together, but this is by far, I think, and I'm not just saying this because, you know, you involved me in the film, but really one of the best put together documentaries. Great storyline, you know, and again, you followed them, you know, throughout all of yours. It's kind of like the Anvil movie where they went on tour with the band and you say you had a limited budget, but you definitely made the most out of it. And it just looks fantastic. Yeah,
I think what's fantastic is also that you get to see a typical American musician living in Europe. And as you know, Chris, the standards are much, much different everywhere you go. And that's what I like as well, because you can really see Chris, even though he hasn't been to the US for the last 6-7 years, he is still 100% American. And that's what people love about him. And what makes, I think, the movie interesting and maybe different is that it's not just the story of an American rock star. It's the story of this American who wants to make it again in Europe. And that's quite a challenge, because you can think it's easy, you just go over here and play in the clubs, but you have to get accustomed to the whole European way of thinking, especially when you come to France. You have to bear with the French people, which is not that easy, I think. But well, Chris managed, so it's impressive.
All right. Well, he'll do it, man. You're on the right track.
I still don't speak a word of French.
You don't need to.
You don't need to. You got the body language.
It's probably better that way, you know, that I don't. I think it's better I don't.
I think the most funny thing is when you go to Chris and Sarah's place, and Sarah's mother is here, and she doesn't speak a single word of French. But still, Chris and his mother-in-law, they managed to understand everything they say to each other, which is impressive. He has the way to communicate with the body language and the laugh, probably. That's why it's working.
Well, right on. Well, once again, the documentary Mean Man, the story of Chris Holmes, the last true rock and roller, available on Cleopatra Entertainment. You can stream it now. Like I said, it's on Amazon Prime, Google Play, whatever streaming services you use, Vudu, available on DVD. And again, the Blu-ray has some great bonus material we're going to be playing coming up. Anything, any closing words you guys would like to say before we end this off?
The last one is for Chris.
I don't, Antoine, did Doug get a hold of you?
Pardon?
My friend Doug, he keeps calling me. I'm like, hey, Doug, I didn't edit it. It's not my job. You know, if I could reach through the phone and punch him, I would, but I can't.
I hope he's going to watch it. No, I finally got Doug, and yeah, that's complicated because there's always different sides to every WASP story. So sometimes you get people mad because you're not going to publish the things the way people want to see it. Mm. And that's why I always wanted to stay neutral. I think it was important.
You need to as a filmmaker, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And even if we had the chance to interview former people from Chris Band who he didn't get along with, I think we would have stayed, put every side to the story, because that's always what people need to know, probably. Sure.
I love just blaming it on Antoine. And you know, it sucks. Look at the mask. Putting the mask on, look what it's doing to my beard. It's ruining my beard right here. Oh. The mask goes right here. You know, I wear those things, man.
You can purchase some beautiful Chris Holmes Mean Man mask if you go on this Bandcamp page, I think.
Oh, there you go. Why don't you give the addresses, the Chris Holmes Bandcamp page, get a Mean Man mask.
Chris can give the page.
Okay. You go on Bandcamp and get it. I would know nothing about it. Bandcamp.
Bandcamp.com.
Yeah,
there you go. How is it there now with, I heard you're having like a second wave, particularly in France, Italy, and Germany. Is it... Is everything closed down still? Is there any word? Go ahead.
In France, there's certain zones, but you know they're like states in a way, but they're more like counties. In France,
right.
We're in a red zone, I guess, yellow, green, or whatever. We're in a lockdown red zone here. I don't know what Paris is like. Is it red zone now, Antoine?
Yeah, we are in the. We both are in the red zones. So
okay, it's in the red zone. Because I think it was 2 days ago, I saw in the news that 650 people died. It's a lot.
Wow.
How many people there are? That's like when America had almost 3,000 a day dying. That's not good.
Yeah.
You know? So, they got to lock down because the virus is still spreading until everybody's vaccinated. You know?
Yeah. Everyone needs to get vaccinated because then they can have Chris Holmes playing again for them.
There you go. Well, Chris just got vaccinated, and stay safe, guys. You know, and we really, everyone in America misses you. I mean, they're glad to see you're doing so well in Europe, but they would love to see you perform out here again. And hopefully we'll be seeing you soon once things get back to normal. And I think by late summer, we should kind of see that.
It should be back to normal, hopefully. You know, if everybody's vaccinated, give them one of these.
Right on. Mm-hmm. All right, gentlemen. Well, it's a pleasure. Definitely support Chris Holmes. Check out the Mean Man documentary, and we will definitely keep in touch, guys.
All right.
Thanks for your support. And
okay, take care, Chris.
Wasp, Metallica, Armored Saint, the end of 84, 85. It was a good tour. We had some good times. That's where I met Cliff Burton, the guy who died. Bass player, funny, fun guy to be around, party animal. He's a cool guy. I tore up a few hotel rooms with the guy. He was cool. You know, sad that happened when he died. We'd played a place called the Channel. I think that was it in Boston, and it was around Christmas time, December, and it was just snowing, and it was cold as shit. And I can remember Lars, it was the first show, come walking in and wanting to borrow the heater, and Blackie told him to fuck off. Get the fuck out of here. And once he left, I go, man, that ain't cool. You know, we should be friends with the guys we're playing with. He goes, we don't have to be friends with anybody, you know. I just thought it was kind of cold. You know, it's shitty. Just treat other people that way. Yeah, I'm glad those guys got to where they deserve it, you know, to get where they're at. They stuck together that long instead of changing musicians and Eagles, Metallica's Eagles are nothing compared to what was in the Wasp camp. Cool guys are from California, so they think and their attitude towards things and stuff like that is just like mine. They treat me the same then, same as now, you know. Iron Maiden had a, I don't know the name of the song, but where everybody came out and sang the backups. They'd come out and sing, whoa, 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 whoa. So that's all I was doing, singing that. That's that Iron Maiden at the Forum. Blackie's one, that was his idea. He wanted to be a sumo wrestler. Go out. Could have been somewhere in time, and before that, Power Slave. I traveled on Steve Harris's bus. I never went on a Wasp bus once. Once, the whole tour. I think the whole 2 months in Europe. I never traveled with Wasp once. It was great. Blackie's happy. Didn't have to put up with my shit on the bus. You know? And I was with some people that were cool, and I, you know, the guys in Iron Maiden treated me at the same level as they were. Didn't look down lower to me. They were cracking up. They don't care. One time I was running off stage after you're done, and Bruce was up on the backside, and he had like a fake gun that shot CO2 out of it, right? And a shot on stage, and he was shooting me in the face. And when I ran off, I ran into the amps and fell down. When we'd go out with Kiss, there'd be a big hassle between the PA, how much PA we'd get, how many lines of merchandising. Two shirts is two lines. They call a line an item. With Kiss, if we got no subs and 80% of PA, we could have 8 lines of merchandising. But if we got 100% of the PA, volume-wise, and subs, we can only have 2 lines. That's just business, you know, because if you're going to have 100% of PA, you're going to what? Sound as good as they do, if not better. And when we went on tour with them, we made sure we got 100% of PA. I told Blackie, I will not tour with them unless we get 100% of PA, I guess, because they're gonna smoke us on sound, and that's important, you know, because I'm a sound nut. A sound freak. I used to work at Sirwin Vega Speaker Company, and I know how speakers work. I know how to mic them. So, if we got full run of their PA, we're gonna sound better than they are. I'll make sure of that. Guitar wise, PA wise, we did.
Chris was very, very cool to us on that tour. He was a great dude. I mean, I have very, very fond memories of hanging out in backstage and like sitting on a road case and just telling stories. And Chris was very cool to us. We were like a bunch of little kids out on that tour and just trying not to get in anybody's way. And Chris kind of went out of his way to be nice to us, I feel like, because he didn't have to be. But he always talked to us and he would like hang out.